So now we'll move seamlessly to the next panel. I'd like to invite Peter McCormick to the podium. Let me just say a few words about him as we thank our speakers again. Peter is Director for Water at Duke University's Nicholas Institute. He also has a very long and distinguished record in a range of water challenges, looking at agriculture, environment, and health sectors. He has extensive international experience. I see in the UK, Ethiopia, Eritrea, India, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Jordan, and as a native Coloradan, I'm interested to see my state on this list, Peter. But in any event, we're delighted to have you with us. Thank you so very much. And now you'll be introducing your own panel. Thank you, Peter. As this looming screen. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric. Well, maybe as a bit of a background, given that lead-in, representing a non-land-grant college, I'm actually a product of a land-grant college, Colorado State University, which Reagan Wascom is here from Colorado State. And I come out of the 80s when the U.S. government was heavily engaged in water and agriculture and sort of left the scene, and perhaps he's coming back. I don't know. But that was a maybe not a segue, but certainly a good lead-in. I think I'll... I just would like to thank Eric and Rachel and colleagues for organizing this this event. In one of my previous roles, I was actually on loan from the International Water Management Institute to USAID in Washington here. This was 2001 through 2005. And this was a pretty lonely time to be talking about water and infrastructure, or even water in general. It definitely was going up. But then water and agriculture were certainly not on the table. So to see this now being discussed, I think this is very, very significant. And particularly, one thing I would like to bring back and emphasize from this morning that as we go into this next session is I think we do need to think a lot more about the water and the environment in this as well, because agriculture, I think the message that's coming through, and we all should have got it by now, but is that no matter what we do, there's going to be more water used in agriculture over the next 20, 30 years. The comprehensive assessment that EME was instrumental in pushing forward. Basically, even if we do all the right things, we're still going to use more water in agriculture. What we need to be thinking about more is what are the lessons from the past? We don't want to be building big, large infrastructure systems that do the damage that was done in the past. We want to be doing this right. And I think we also need to think about parts of the world looking at one thing that we probably hasn't come out yet is what is happening, what's going to happen in Africa? Because Africa is seen as an opportunity. There's water there, the development hasn't happened, and we're certainly seeing things around the competitiveness. This is where the water resources are. We're certainly seeing things in certain countries occurring there that we should be paying attention to, and I think that certainly it's many of the people here looking at how the dynamics are going to change in around water and agriculture. I think this is something that we can pay attention to. With that, I would like to just move on to the panel on water and agricultural competitiveness, but clearly in the big picture, water and agriculture is going to become quite competitive. We have three distinguished speakers. We have Dr. Maria Saleth from the, I have to look at his new organization because he and I were colleagues together in the International Water Management Institute. He's now with the Madras Institute of Development Studies in India. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with Maria's work in institutions and water institutions in India and elsewhere. We also have Yasmina Zaidman from the Acumen Fund, and she will be talking about the market-based technology delivery for water efficiency in agriculture. And finally, we have Chu Chung from the University of Minnesota, who will be looking at water issues in China and impacts on trade, growth, and development. With that, I would just like Maria Saleth to come to the table.
Is there a light here? I could see. There's no light on this. have I entered here?
Thank you, Peter, and I also grateful for this opportunity to talk about an issue on which most of you are already familiar. This is about this role of institution in irrigation management in India. As you know, in India, water is agriculture because 80% of the water is used for agriculture, but though agriculture is not water because only 30% of the area irrigated by water, the remaining is rain-fed. And so I'm going to actually tell you a small story about the main problems, water problems in India, and on which I think you could put together various kind of perspectives, including some theories of reforms or things like that. And I also wanted actually to tell the story without numbers. So I'm going to the major problem in India. I think this applies to most countries in Asia, including China. The major problem is there is a physical gap. That is, the amount of water resources available and the water resources that we can actually use. So I think in India we have about little less than 2,000 billion cubic meters of water, annual water, of which we could only use about 1,200 billion cubic meter because of various constraints in using the water. And because of this gap in using this water, we have the other gap, which is the supply gap. So the amount of water we actually developed out of the utilizable potential is about 640 billion cubic meter. But as compared to the demand in 2005 or 2025 or 2050, by 2050, I think we are going to the demand we could supply only means we can meet just the demand, after which there will be a scarcity. But this is only a macro picture, but the micro level, this problem, water scarcity problem is, they are already visible in many parts of India, especially where most populations are located and most agriculture is located. And because this supply gap is also due to the financial, we don't have enough resources to develop, even though there are natural physical limits for developing all the water that we can have. And we also don't have the resources, final resources, to add more to the supply. And the financial gap, actually, I think John is here. I think I will be using some little numbers, so I wanted not to use number. About 780 billion rupees of total investment, and the cost of supplying water about 30 billion Indian rupees. But the water that the user charge that we get back from farmers is only 3 billion. So there are several things. So we spent more, and we also spend more in supplying the service, but we only get little. So because of that, the sector is not generating resources to be invested in developing additional supply. And because of this financial gap, we also have the incentive gap. That is the gap between the true value of water and the value underlying current use pattern. So for instance, as a crude measure of this incentive gap, the water productivity, that is just the difference between the yield from a rain-fed region and an irrigated area. So this difference taken as an indicator of water productivity, it ranges from 700 to 6,000 rupees per hectare. But the charge, the amount of money that they pay because of the low water charges is in the range of 90 to 600 rupees per hectare. So since water is charged suboptimally, so there is the farmers do not have the incentive to conserve that water. All these problems have an underlying institutional gap. That is, as we are approaching the scarcity era, gradually, the institutions which were involved in developing, distributing, and managing water, they are not moving at the same level. So there is a gap between what type of institutions we need and what type of institutions we have. I think today we have an excellent presentation from John about the importance of water rights. So that is the type of institution we need, but we don't have it. So that is the gap. And because of that gap, which is contributing to the physical gap, for one reason is that there is a conflict between states. I think John talked about entitlements for regions, sub-regions and sectors and within among users, so on and so forth. Those entitlements are not there. Because of that, there is a conflict in sharing water. I also wanted to point out what John told about the declining investment, World Bank investment in water sector. I think a large proportion of which is going to India. Because the water that we can develop easily without any conflicts among people, we have already exhausted. So further development involves conflict between one region or the other, which is a constraint for funding agency to invest. So because of that, we are not able to use all the water potential available to us. And it is also contributing the supply gap that we are not having demand management tools to match the demand and supply, including water markets. And this also has this financial gap. This is also underlying factor. We don't have a pricing policy, for instance. Our cost recovery policy is not tuned to the changing situation. And the same fact also explains why people are not having the incentive to conserve water. As we could imagine, this involves a huge loss, or what you call as an opportunity cost of not doing any change. And this, I think various estimates are available about what is the magnitude of this cost. I think there are estimates about 4% of India's GDP may be involved as a form of these losses. If we capture all loss, including the financial gap, and also the lost output that we are not getting due to these gaps, it will be 4%. I think it amounts to about $16 billion, which is a very big amount. And if anybody wants, I can discuss how this is obtained. But this is a very big amount of money. And with that loss, so there is a clear reason for going for reforms. Institutions. So we know that institution reforms are not easy, and they also involve cost in creating new institution or adjusting new existing institutions, so on and so forth. So and one of the central component of those institutional reforms should be based on water rights and entitlements. And, of course, creating that, the economic loss, which is actually the social cost or the opportunity cost of not doing anything, actually provide a strong ground for creating the necessary institutional change centered on water institution, water rights and entitlements. And already we have a lot of potential for creating such system. I think John already mentioned about the in Maharashtra, they already started introducing that bulk water entitlements to different canal or distributaries. It's it's a bulk water level. It is not yet gone to the user level, but this is a beginning. And we also have so many traditional irrigation system, localized, where the rights, water rights are experimented with some success. And also the increasing relevance of international experience, including Pakistan, of how to create these water rights and entitlements. And so this actually calls for major reforms, not just introducing water rights. Then we have to do a lot of modernization of our canal network to allow volumetric distribution, and also the user organizations to manage the allocation at the outlet level, at the regional and the system level and the basin level, so on and so forth. So it calls for major changes, but it should be centered, the core of that reform should be the creation of water rights or entitlements. And here we know that there is a clear rationale for change, but politics come into play. And so it is being delayed, so on and so forth. So now the major conflict is between politics and economics, whether this huge cost is going to win or it is the political resistance to change which is going to win. This is the question. But there are a lot of evidences that the economic factors are deep-rooted and they are going to move the political system to create the institutions that we require. So with that, I think let me end this presentation. Thank you for this opportunity.
Is it not showing up?
Is this it?
I don't think this. No, it should be the renewable drive.
Okay.
Yeah, recovery week. Is that one opening?
Okay.
Oh, that one. And scroll down. It's
this
one right here. Thank you for your rapt attention. So I'm Yasmina Zaidman. I'm with Acumen Fund. And just set this down. I think what we're starting to see really clearly is the complexity of the issues of water, and particularly water and agriculture. So what I'm sort of thinking about as I talk about my presentation is how to contextualize Acumen Fund within all the different kinds of things we're hearing, from policy questions. I think we'll be hearing from someone from the private sector later. And, of course, there's a lot of NGOs doing work in this space, whether it's research or trying to provide solutions. Acumen Fund is kind of unique in its attempt to fill a niche between the public sector in terms of looking at public goods and also the private sector in terms of looking at capital and sources of capital. So I'll try to paint a picture of what we do and then focus in on our work, particularly in the area of agriculture. We are a nonprofit venture fund that invests in businesses that provide critical goods and services to the poor. There's some sort of conflicting ideas there. We are basically a nonprofit that works with philanthropic capital to invest in businesses that are solving social problems. We use philanthropic capital because it gives us the flexibility as investors to invest in businesses that are really focusing on the needs of the poor, often in emerging markets where the investment environment is much riskier, and most investors really steer clear either of emerging markets altogether or specifically of entrepreneurs that serve low-income consumers. So to date, we've invested about $40 million in 30 different companies. We're looking at health, water, housing, and energy as areas for investment. We not only provide capital, but also focus on the need for management support to help scale businesses that can meet the needs of the poor in innovative ways. We do that by providing management support for our own team, but we also have fellows that we place with these companies, and we've placed about 26 fellows with the companies that we invest in. And then finally, from these investments, we hope to see social impact as these companies scale and reach significant numbers of customers. We hope to see them reach 1 million customers within a 5-year period. We also see financial sustainability and companies that are able to go to private capital markets to get growth capital. And we also see lessons learned, which brings me to why I'm here today, because I wanted to share some of what we've learned from the businesses that we've invested in, particularly related to drip irrigation. I'm going to look at Pakistan and India as two countries where we've worked. You've just heard, I think, a lot about the challenges around agricultural use of water, the dependence of not only general population but particularly the poor on agriculture as a source of their livelihoods. And this is particularly true, I think, in South Asia where a lot of our investing has been done. We see drip irrigation, which was mentioned earlier by Jason Clay, as a real potential solution. Drip irrigation can allow people to use their scarce water resources more efficiently. I think there's a mistake sometimes in thinking that irrigation can reduce water use. I think that in some cases it can, but what we've seen is that farmers need to use the water they have to increase their output. They're not necessarily going to cut in half the amount of water they use. They'll probably use the same amount of water but increase their productivity. It also reduces labor and soil erosion, which we've already heard is a huge issue in terms of spending the principal when it comes to the assets that smallholder farmers have to work with. We identified a technology in 2003 in India that had been developed by an organization called International Development Enterprises India, which is a sister organization to International Development Enterprises. They had been working for around 7 years to refine a technology that does drip irrigation but at a very low cost. And they had developed some insights about how to create a product that would really be attractive to farmers who earn, on average, less than a dollar a day. That was their target market. There are certainly many farmers in India who make more than that, but they wanted to focus on those who were living below the poverty line. And what they found was that those farmers needed to have a product that would give them a return on their investment within 1 year, that they were not in a position to make a longer-term investment, and they didn't want to force farmers to borrow money to buy this product because farmers, I think, had already experienced a lot of negative downsides to borrowing for their inputs. And if you want to track incidents of drought in parts of India, what you often see is a huge increase in farmer suicides when farmers are unable to pay the people that they owe money to when their crops fail. So this was a cycle that they didn't want to have anything to do with. They wanted a 1-year return on investment. They wanted a technology that could be miniaturized so that farmers, even with a quarter acre, could make their first investment in the technology and then scale up either as they had more land or they had access to more resources to buy inputs. The product increases yields by 30% and also allows farmers to have multiple crops in a year. So instead of doing one crop when the rains fall, they could do three crops using their water resources more carefully. So this seemed like a real win. We saw an opportunity to work with them to help them build this business model and at the same time move them towards a more commercial model where they themselves, as an organization, could become financially sustainable. As a nonprofit, they had been focusing on designing this product and building market demand for it, but they were still, the margins in this whole sales cycle were going to the manufacturers and the distributors, and they themselves were subsidized through grants. We thought about how their model could scale if they actually could make their own operations sustainable, and so we worked with them over a period of time to build a for-profit company that is now selling these systems much more widely. At the same time, we started working with a group in Pakistan called the Tar Rural Development Program, and they were working with a network of thousands of villages through some of the most arid parts of Pakistan, and they saw a real opportunity to work with this same product. So we worked with the two of them to do a technology transfer, and it's a really nice phrase and it sounds really easy, but the reality is that getting two organizations in two geographies that have been some level of conflict for many, many years now was very tough. Even just getting visas to get people from one organization to visit the other was really challenging. And it took 2 years for that relationship to really develop, to allow them to spend time face-to-face to do site visits, to actually see how drip irrigation was working in India. But eventually what we saw was that the two organizations were really inspired by each other and found an opportunity to partner. Within that period of time, both of them launched for-profit companies, and we were able to invest $1.5 million in the two companies. $500,000 of debt and equity went into the company in Pakistan to build up their business, and $1 million went into the for-profit company launched by ID India, which is called Global Easy Water Products. And we saw this as a real milestone in terms of bringing a product that was really designed for the poorest farmers into a more commercial landscape. The impact in India and Pakistan has been tremendous. GEWP was really building on the success of ID India, and they've sold, over the sort of transition from those two organizations, 250,000 systems, benefiting about 1.2 million people. The pilots in Pakistan by MicroDrip, which is their for-profit company, have been successful, and they're in the process of scaling up. We've also learned a lot about what it takes to be successful. One is around design innovation, that the drip irrigation has been around for a long time, but it was really designed for a different market, of much larger farms, more high-value cash crops, people who basically could invest $1,200 or $2,000 an acre to develop these automated efficient systems. But looking at the dollar-a-day farmer required a real sort of shift in how you think about the product. And both of these organizations we selected because of their ability to listen to the poor and to really see them as customers, and their willingness to continually innovate. And so they've made changes to the product since we've known them. They continue to add new products to their portfolio to really respond to the needs of small-scale farmers. We've also been, I think, perpetually impressed and amazed by the depth of understanding and knowledge of these farmers who are willing to make an investment when it makes sense for them and have a real nuanced understanding of the different trade-offs that they have to make when it comes to, you know, where to take risks, where to invest, and how to manage the resources that they have. The other thing that we've seen for both companies is the importance of building distribution networks and the time that it takes to do that. So technology is really not the fix. Most of these product designs can very easily be reverse engineered. You can look at them and figure out how to make them. What makes these companies unique and successful is that they are building the infrastructure for distribution and marketing that can take years to build. And it also requires patience, I think, on the part of investors or donors to allow that infrastructure for distribution to develop. I mentioned aggregating markets because one thing we've seen is the potential to aggregate markets by working with organizations that pool different groups of smallholder farmers, whether it's the supply chain for sugarcane for Coca-Cola or organizations that do fair trade. All of them are working with networks of farmers, and if you can build a supply chain using that existing infrastructure, it can really save a lot of time and resources. I also wanted to touch briefly on the point of subsidies because I think there's sort of an underlying assumption that in order to accelerate the development of these technologies and their wide distribution to people who need them, there may be a need for subsidies. We've seen subsidies both help to expand access to these products. We've also seen them hurt. And so I just want to bring that up, and hopefully we can have more of a discussion on it later. Where we've seen subsidies hurt is when they benefit particular manufacturers who often have more expensive products and maybe better resources to work with the government and sort of create an arrangement where they can get subsidies. Even if the subsidy goes to the customer, it can easily benefit one company. That makes it harder for entrepreneurs who are maybe offering a more competitive product, and that's been a challenge, I think, for both of these companies. The other issue we've seen is that the farmers who need the subsidies the most often have the hardest time accessing them. They may not have the means, the connections, the ability to go to a city hall, fill out the right forms in order to get access. and there's a waiting time to get refunded for their investments in drip irrigation. So the whole system seems like it doesn't really focus on the needs of the poorest, which sort of raises the question of why are these subsidies being used in this way? The question that we've sort of thought to ourselves is, where is the right place for subsidies? And as we're thinking about the use of whether it's donated dollars or invested dollars, how do you use those in the right way? As I look at the whole supply chain, from R&D for the product, manufacturing, wholesale distribution to networks of distributors, and then retail distribution, marketing and sales, and then the purchase and after-sales service, there's two key places where we've seen grants and subsidies play a really key role in accelerating the marketplace. One is in R&D, which again is a process that takes time to be able to refine a product, test it out, and that's an area where if you have support early on, you have an opportunity to innovate, take risks, try things out without having the pressure of the market forcing you to cut that process short. We've also seen around marketing and sales, the work to educate consumers, to provide pilots, to demonstrate how a product is used. Again, it can take time, and it's hard to recover those costs. Where we've seen that subsidies aren't necessarily needed is for manufacturers. Once that market demand is there, we've seen them jumping into the fray to start to create these products. We've also seen it possible for distributors to immediately start to get a margin and not require that subsidy. So these are some lessons that we've taken away from the work. To sort of paint a more vivid picture of what this means, this is one of the families in Pakistan that got access to this technology about a year and a half ago. And this is, very typical family living in the Tar region. It's very arid. They have about one season in which to grow crops, and the rest of the year they actually leave their homes so that they can make money elsewhere. When they got access to drip irrigation, they were able to do a bumper crop of sunflowers and earn enough to stay home, not have to leave and migrate to the city. They were able to send their children to school for the first time, and they're firm believers that this is a product that will continue to move them out of poverty. Our founder, Jacqueline Novogratz, visited this farmer and had a chance to ask him what this meant in his life. And his proudest, I think the biggest change for him and the thing that he was proudest of was that he was able to send his daughters to school. And she said, "Why is that so important to you?" And he said, "If my daughters go to school, they will learn tolerance. And that's what we need now." And to hear that from someone living in Pakistan, where depending on where you are, there's conflict still between different ethnic groups, religious groups, border areas, that this is how people see themselves moving out of poverty, being able to fulfill their aspirations. That is for us the biggest takeaway, and the value of seeing the poor not as beneficiaries, sort of an anonymous mass, but really as individuals who are aspiring to improve their own lives. And it's why we work with entrepreneurs that see them the same way and try to serve their needs to the best of their abilities. Thank you. I'm just trying to take it out, but I can get it later.
So I'm going to talk about China's water issues. So China's water problem have raised lots of concerns inside China and also internationally. The extent of the water problem will have strong implications for China's future agricultural production and also China's trade position in key crops. So in my talk today, I'll first focus on understanding whether there is water crisis in China. I'll then talk about what the farmers and the government are doing when faced with water crisis and whether past water policies have been successful in resolving the water problems. I'll also discuss some potential solutions that our research has pointed out, answering the question that who can build a bridge over China's troubled waters. Most of the work I presented here today is done by myself and jointly with my co-authors, Professor Scott Rosell from Stanford University, and Jinxiang Wang and Ji Kun Huang from Center for Chinese Agriculture Policy. So over the past several decades, China's grain production has been increasing continuously at a fast rate. Irrigation is among the most important factors that push this growth. However, with the growth of China's economy, the availability of water for agriculture is declining. On the demand side, agriculture is losing water to rising demand in other sectors such as industry and residential sector. We can see that the share of water used in agriculture dropped from 85% in 1978 to 62% in 2007. Agriculture also has a lower priority relative to other sectors in terms of water use. On the supply side, past water projects has tapped out almost all of the surface water in North China. We can see that in High River Basin, which is one of the major river basins in North China, the surface water flows have reduced to almost zero in recent years. With the decline in surface water supply, farmers have started to rely more and more heavily on groundwater for irrigation. The number of tube wells increased continuously at a fast rate since 1950s. There was almost no wells in 1950s, but by 2004, it was estimated that there was more than 7.6 million wells in China. We can see that except for rice, for most crops in North China, groundwater is a major source of irrigation water. But as a result of this fast development of groundwater irrigation, water levels start to decline in many places in North China. Given this decline in water supply and rising water demand, more and more people are asking the question, is China facing a water crisis? Lots of people say yes. They believe that the water crisis is affecting China's grain production. It could even push China to starve the world because China would have to rely on food produced outside of China, and the massive volumes of imports by China would raise food prices internationally. There's also a group of people believe that a good policy can solve the problems. That is, sound policy bridges can be built over even the most troubled water. So who is right? Whom should we blame for the water crisis? And what can be done to resolve the problem? Unfortunately, despite the importance of this issue, most studies and discussions on this issue are only based on case studies or anecdotes. But without empirical evidence that comes from national representative data, it's not possible for us to even know whether there really is a nationwide crisis in China. So the first objective of our research is to get the facts right. To do so, in 2005, we did a North China Water Resource Survey. In the survey, we used a stratified random sampling strategy and generated a sample of villages that are representative of North China. So in total, we collected data in 400 villages in the six provinces. Using our survey data, we then plot the distribution of depth to water in our sample areas. We can see that the average depth to water was 26 meters in our sample villages, but it varied. Depth to water varied across our sample villages. You can see that for most of the villages, the depth to water is between 0 and 50%, so 50 meters. So you can see the distribution, most of the distribution concentrated in this region. But we can also, there are also some villages that are pumping from more than 100 meters. We also can see that distribution of 2004, which is the red line here, shifted a little bit to the right of the distribution of 1995, indicating that water are getting deeper over years. But when we examined the changed water level in more details, we found what may be, to some observers, a fairly surprising result. Most importantly, our data reveal that not all regions in North China are experiencing decline in water levels. In 26% of the villages, water level did not change between 1995 and 2004. In another 9% of villages, the water level actually increased, probably due to recharge from rainfall. If we also include those villages whose level fell less than 0.25 meters per year, which is 18% of villages, we can say that up to half of our sample villages, groundwater have shown little or no decline over the past decade. At the same time, we also see that there are a large number of villages that have water levels that are falling over years. In 38% of the villages, the water level fell between 0.25 meters and 0.5 meters per year. In 11% of the villages, water level fell more than 1.5 meters per year. So waters in those villages are definitely troubled. So to answer the question, is China facing a water crisis? According to our study, the most accurate answer is probably both yes and no. On the one hand, we see that the water level is only falling rapidly in a fraction of the villages. So it certainly cannot be called a full-blown crisis. On the other hand, we also see that those villages that are in crisis represent a large number, almost half our villages. So it is a serious problem. So where there's a problem is a response by the government. In the past, the government has designed a lot of water laws and launched a number of policy measures in attempt to deal with the problems. But in terms of the actual implementation, we find that there's almost zero effort. In our sample villages, less than 10% of the well owners actually obtained permits before drilling the wells. Less than 5% of villages have any requirement on well spacing. In none of the villages that is the water extraction fee imposed, there's no restrictions on how much water farmers can pump. So in short, there's almost zero implementation of those policy measures. We're not saying that the government is lazy. The reality is that it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to control over 7 million wells. So is the government building the bridge? Obviously not. Are policymakers a part of troubling the waters? We say yes, through their non-action. What about farmers? Is there a response by farmers? The most obvious response of farmers is to sink tube wells. We see a clear, strong trend of increasing privatization of wells. So you can see that in Hebei and Henan province, the share of wells that are owned by individual farmers instead of the village instead of the village collective increased from 7% in 1983 to 81% in 2004. Our sixth province survey also indicate that by 2004, 69% of wells are private wells. So with the shift of this well ownership, the management of groundwater resource also shifted into the hands of individual farmers. Although our research showed that privatization of wells does increase technical efficiency in agricultural production, mostly through more timely delivery of water, the privatization of wells does not reduce water use. In surface water using area, we also observe a clear trend of reform. In 1995, in 90% of villages, the village council was managing canals, and this share dropped to 72% in 2004. In more and more villages, either water user associations are managing the canals, or the village council contracted canals out to water managers. So our research also showed that WA or contracting can save water if water managers can earn money from saving water. But only a small proportion of WA or contracting are provided with such incentive to save water. So are farmers building a bridge? Probably not. Are farmers a part of troubling the waters? Since they are the water users, so almost by definition, yes. But is it their fault? Could it be that they're just doing what we should expect them to do, given the policy environment? And could it be that they would just as easily be part of the solution, given the right incentives? In fact, our research has shown us the basis of some bridges, that is water pricing policy, followed with the adoption of water saving technology. Our research showed that farmers would respond to higher prices by reducing water use. So because in North China, the cost of groundwater is mostly just the energy cost, electricity, diesel fuel to pump water out. So there's almost, you can see there's almost a linear relationship between depth and water and the cost of water. We can also see that as water gets deeper, farmers are using less water. So in the first row, the bottom 20 percentile, so the average depth is about 4 meters. Farmers are using on average 500 cubic meters per mu. Mu is the unit of land in China. So farmers are using 500 cubic meter per mu to irrigate wheat. While on the top 25 percentiles, where farmers are paying much more for water, the water use reduced dramatically to 150 meters per mu. Farmers also respond to higher water prices by changing crop mix. We can see that the share of land allocated to high-value crop, cash crop, fruits and vegetables, increases as water gets deeper. For farmers that are in top 20 percentile of the distribution, where the water is most deep, the share is as high as 40%. This is what we observed in our field visits. For example, in one of the counties we visited, in Hebei province, which is the bottom picture, Cang County, where the water level have dropped pretty fast, farmers are started to grow more and more fruit trees. But while in another county, this is in the same province where water is relatively abundant, not many changes have been observed. So if China do increase price for price of water by taxing electricity or diesel fuel, we would expect to see a sharp decline in water demand. We actually have a set of simulation analysis that's showing this. This will lead to lots of water savings, probably increasing adoption of water saving technology. So in our survey, we also collected data on water saving technology. We divide them into three different categories depending on their characteristics. We can see that for all three categories, the adoption rate is actually pretty low. For example, for the community-based technology, such as line canals, sprinklers, the adoption rate was only 7% of the zone area in 2004. So those numbers don't look good. But if we look at them in optimistic way, we see lots of rooms for policy that target at increasing adoption rate. And one such policy is water pricing policy. In fact, the low water prices is the reason we observe those low adoption rates, because if water is cheap, farmers will not have any incentive to save water. Of course, if we do increase the price of water, farmers would suffer income losses from high irrigation costs. So we would also need a set of complementary policies that would offset those negative income effects. So in conclusion, there is a regional water crisis in China. Past water policies have not been effective in resolving the problems. So as the water prices increase, either from water pricing policy or from falling water levels, we're probably going to see the production of water-using crops to reduce. We're going to see much less winter wheat, which requires lots of irrigation. Or we're probably going to observe a shift from wheat maize rotation to single season maize. We're probably even going to see a shift from rice to maize. So is this going to be a problem? We think not. The reason is because the domestic demand for food grains such as wheat and rice is declining in China. There's also a rising demand for meat in China, and which means that derived demand for maize is also increasing. In addition, most researchers believe that supply response in international markets would also dampen the impact of China's rising imports on international prices. We already see that higher water prices will direct farmers to more high-value crops, There's also rising demand for fruits and vegetables in domestic and export markets. So although fruits and vegetables are water intensive, they're also high value. So we expect to see rising investment into greenhouses and water saving technologies such as lined canals, sprinklers, or maybe drip irrigation, things like this. So finally, the water problems is going to cause some tension and stress in China. There's going to be costs associated with shifting crops and those new investments. But China, like many other developing countries, are ready to build a bridge over troubled waters. Who is the director of Agriculture Division, Development and Reform Commission, said in 2004 that if I knew a water policy worked and if I knew where an investment would have the most effect, I would allocate up to a quarter of my budget to this one activity. And with that, I'll end my talk today. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are three very interesting presentations, quite diverse views on water and economic growth and what is happening in China and India and Pakistan. We also have similar situation going on, or similar dynamics, or the dynamics impacting Africa in similar ways. My asking questions at the moment, I'll open it up to the floor and then I'll interject my questions as we go forward. Are there any kickoff questions at this point to either of our presenters? Yes.
My name is Susan Murcott. I'm from MIT. My question is to Yasmina. Greetings, Yasmina. I am interested in learning a few more details about your $1.5 million investment. Your India company sold 250,000 units. I'm wondering if the company is profitable at this point, if it's breaking even. It's been in existence for how many years? You know that we go back and forth on this in conversations together.
Absolutely. It's good to see you, Susan. So I unfortunately don't have all the latest details on the financial metrics, although with almost all the companies we invest in, they do provide us with quarterly updates, which is one of the benefits of being an investor. They have some sort of accountability to us in that regard. I know that the for-profit company has only been around for about a year and a half, and they had the great advantage of being kind of built on the platform of a nonprofit that had already spent around 7 years developing a market, presenting this product in the marketplace. But I know that they have been growing quickly. So I would guess that they're probably not profitable right now, but that their growth is leading them towards becoming profitable in the next 3 or 4 years.
And in terms of Acumen's investment, how does it work with Acumen getting a return on that investment?
Oh, so the way it works is we invest both debt and equity in different, you know, depending on the right kind of capital. So when we invest debt, we do charge interest. It's typically far below what a commercial bank in that sector would charge because they have a big risk premium that they add on to startup businesses or businesses that serve the poor, or they can't get capital from banks at all. But in any case, we sort of structure the debt so that it's allowing the company to grow and it doesn't create an excessive burden on them as they are going through their first few years of growth.
So what's the interest rate then on that debt, do you know?
I don't know the exact interest rate, and we don't usually publicize it because then everyone who hears an interest rate is like, well, that'll be my interest rate, and it does vary depending on...
Say, how does it compare to, say, microfinance interest rates?
Oh, much lower.
Much lower.
Much lower, because the transaction costs for microfinance are so high that their rates tend to be up around 20%. And ours are going to be closer to the local cost of capital, which would be like a prime interest rate, which would be for a well-established company, which, again, these startups don't usually have access to. So they're, you know, it's slightly below what the market would charge, but it's something that you would see in the market. So maybe again, depending on the economy that we're talking about, somewhere between 7 to 10%.
But then do these startup companies have the capacity to set up these loan arrangements with you, and are they doing that internationally? Are you sending people back and forth to India?
Well, we have offices in all the countries that we invest because we've just found that it's a much, much more effective way to find investment opportunities and then to provide the ongoing management support. We also really need to focus on what are the, investing cross-border is not a simple thing to do, so we need to really understand the local legal context. There's a million reasons why our approach itself is not designed to be profitable because the transaction costs, again, would scare away any investor that's really trying to make money. So that's sort of the way we look at debt, is trying to structure it so that it really helps the company grow and also allows them to graduate to getting debt from other local sources down the road. So again, if we charge a zero interest loan, it's harder for them to make the case that they could manage a more commercial loan. But after working with us for a few years, they're often in a great position to then go to a local bank and say, we have a track record. In the case of equity, we don't have the same kinds of thresholds that a lot of typical equity investors would have, where they want to see a pretty quick turnaround and really large return on investment. We have a longer-term horizon. We're hoping to get all of our capital back. If there is some sort of upside on our equity investments, all of that goes back into our fund. And we hope that any upside that we do see would offset what we expect from the overall portfolios, that we won't see a huge upside because of the transaction costs. So again, we're in a weird space because if you look at the investment by itself, it looks a little bit commercial. But if you look at the way we work and who we invest in, this is just not a market that is attractive to investors right now. So that's where our costs come in terms of management support, finding these entrepreneurs, working with them, even structuring the relationship between ID India and Tardeep. It was a two-year process and something that we saw having a huge potential social impact, but we'll never recover the cost of spending 2 years to figure out how to do this technology transfer, and that's not really what motivates us.
And do you have social indicators as well as financial indicators that you're tracking your progress with?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's nice about our model is that the social impact is positively correlated with the financial impact. So because these companies are serving the poor directly, they don't take a portion of their profits and donate it to a good cause. Basically, their products are delivered to this income segment. So as they grow, we look at, who are their customers, what is their income level. What we don't necessarily do is have the resources to do a long-term evaluation of the social impact of each of these beneficiaries, because those studies take a lot more resources than we have. But it is basically why we make the investment. So we do track it carefully over time. And you and I should catch up and keep talking about this because we've struggled with these same issues, not only in agriculture, but also in safe drinking water and sanitation.
Okay, another question? I have a question for Chu Chung. In terms of, in your last slide, you mentioned the supply response in international markets. And I was wondering to what extent you'd looked at that in terms of what this means in the international markets and what that response is, what the effects of that response is likely to be. Because my concern is lots of countries are making the same assumption and what this might mean globally.
This is not my own research, so I don't really know much about it. So, but I know Brad Loma and James Hansen at ERS. They used the China model of ERS to look at what happens if the irrigated acreage has to reduce. What's going to happen? And what they see is that actually, in other regions of China and in USA, there's going to be increased production of wheat if North China is going to reduce wheat production. But I don't remember the exact number.
Rachel Posner with CSIS. My question is for Dr. Seleth. You mentioned in your presentation that if there were continued development in India, that there could be conflict. And so I wanted to hear you expand on that a little bit, and if there were any instances that you could tell us about that have kind of happened already. We always get questions at CSIS about water and conflict, and so we would be interested to hear what you've seen on the ground over there.
Yes.
Actually, the demand for water being is projected based on certain assumptions about our population growth. So they have several scenarios of population growth. So according to one scenario, which assumes a higher population growth, by 2050, that all the water that can be used in India, usable water, will be exhausted. So at the macro level, overall country level, 2050 or around that time, India will use all its water. So that is the one point. The second point, this at the micro level of smaller basins, which Peter may be knowing as well, is small basin level. There are some basins which are already using more water than they already have, partly due to recycling, so on and so forth. So in some of them are using about 60-70% of the water resource potential for irrigation. So it means the remaining is for domestic and industrial uses, which is also growing. So the normal assumption is that whenever a basin 60% of the water is used, then it is crossing a danger zone actually. So there are several areas where it already happened, and there are some rivers which they have a conflict between states in capturing water. One is the case of Kaveri water, which many times of our it even have some political ramifications, threatening the stability of the central government, which, since it is based on coalition partners. Those political implications are there all the time. So that's why when I entered the presentation with that, whether the politics can win or the economics can win, actually the economy is going to win because of its political implications, because politics is not immune from economic consideration in the long run. But you're right, there are several hot areas where this problem is already visible.
Maybe not questions. I think I want to make comments to Ms. Huang. Yes. When you look at the water policy, the first to know understood the food policy in China, and in the next decades, Chinese government will maintain cereal self-sufficiency at least 95. For maize, I think is 98. For winter wheat, it's 93. For rice, it's 100%. So the national strategies. So it's difficult to say that we can reduce wheat production because it's used a lot of water. The second, when you look at the pricing water, and you must consider about cereal pricing system, because I mentioned this morning that our cereal price is still remain to very low levels. And third comments, I think that Michael already mentioned in lunch sessions that about water quality in agriculture, it could be the biggest challenge in next decade. Thank you.
More questions?
For the self-sufficiency of this 95%, we're not saying that China's government is going to take action to reduce wheat production. We're saying that there is a regional crisis in China, and water availability for agriculture is declining. And there's not so far there have not been water policies that's very being successful in resolving this water scarcity problem. So in the face of increasing water scarcity, rising water prices, farmers are going to respond by reducing wheat production, switch to high-value crops. So that's we are mostly talking about the reaction to the water resource situation. So maybe the government is going to come up with more policies to try to stick to the 95%. But But as far as I can see, water resources is going to be one of the limiting factors. And we already see that since 2003, China already increased the imports of wheat. So that's just a natural trend for me.
No.
Peter, we have internet.
Okay, good. This is from the internet, and is there any successful examples on reforming institutions at the state level? That's a good question.
I think there are several instances, small success stories that we can tell. In fact, I have a paper in this. We have find areas where are the positive changes. One is actually the recent the introduction of bulk water delivery system in Maharashtra, where the water right system is being introduced. And the other thing is that in several states the water rates have been increased. Increased means it is not to the tune which is needed, but at least there is a change. And also the institutional change or reform is a very long-term process. So in order to see the final result, there will be long-term. But in between, we could see some small kind of indicators or signs. One of the signs is the changing language of policymakers. You know, earlier they will not commit for, say, privatization of water delivery system or something. But actually there is a committee, the Government of India established the committee in 1995 to study the issue of privatizing water development and provisions. So it means this is how the changes are happening, small dots here and there. Then eventually, you know, they become small blocks and the change happened that way. So there are several instances on that we can cite, including those initiatives by farmers themselves. One of the instances is the water markets, which is widely practiced in many parts of the country. And there are estimates that up to 50% of the area irrigated in groundwater regions may be due to water marketing. So to that extent, there is some efficiency and equity benefits are there. Thank you.
Question here.
Hi, my name's Duncan. I'm with the World Bank. I just wanted to know, I'm interested on the last question to know, Peter, your involvement with Colorado briefly, and to some extent there's state issues in the United States, so there's clearly state issues with places like Bihar and Maharashtra in India. Chuchong, I just wondered, are there examples where these kind of state conflict issues are coming into play in China as well? It's much harder to see these kind of issues because of the more perhaps top-heavy nature of the Chinese government at times to be able to understand whether these issues are also at play in China too.
As far as I can see, I think the most conflicts comes from Yellow River Basin. So, for example, one of the province we serve is Ningxia Province. Ningxia Province is the upstream of Yellow River Basin, and they got lots of water. But then those provinces in the lower reach, like Henan Province, Shandong Province, they don't get enough water. So those provinces are fighting for water every year, and they're trying to say, okay, we want Ningxia Province to save water, so to reallocate to lower reach provinces. But then Ningxia Province saying, okay, why do I want to save water? I don't benefit unless you give me some benefits of saving those water. Otherwise, I'm not going to do it. So that's one of the major water conflicts. And China's government is trying to use water rights reallocate of those water resources to resolve the problem. But the thing is that Ningxia province would not want to give up their historical allocation of water. So how do you deal with those political issues? So that's one of the major problems in China.
And maybe I would like to at least add something to that. On Maria Seleth was referring to, I've been involved in the Krishna Basin in southern India more than other parts of India. And there you have, it's somewhat like a small Colorado River. You have three states sort of trying to share that water out. But you have these challenges around. This morning, John was showing the lower, this old rice systems at the bottom of the river. But what has happened is the water has slowly moved up the basin because you've had the cities developing, you have new agriculture developing, you've now got the sugar cane and the milk production further upstream being. And it's basically, although there are some institutional systems in place, they're not adequate to sort of manage that process. And now what we've seen in the last 20 years is the large-scale infrastructure took the water off and used it for irrigation. But now in the last 20 years, it's really been the small-scale intervention, small dams, wells, and that's kept the hydrology going down. And so the institutional structure that Maria Seleth was talking about, the reforms, this is the sort of thing that's very complicated in and politically charged. This tension that he was talking about is very politically charged in that situation. And I'll get back to my original point that I opened with. At the end, it's the environmental flows that will end up. Agriculture will take it from the cities. Will take it from agriculture. Agriculture will eventually take it from the environment. So it's a really tricky process to try and manage. But I think the reality is we have to. This is where the challenges are. This is the way agriculture is an opportunity, but at the same time, there's some very complex things that we have to keep managing. I think with that, I hate to be the person closing out the session, but I think we've covered many dimensions of the problem, and I would just like to thank our three speakers for coming here and making the presentations. Thank you.
And Peter, thank you very much for your skilled chairmanship of this session.